think Tevez going to Juventus, what a coup that was for me. I mean,
on a head-to-head battle, Atletico Madrid can do more damage to Barcelona than the other way around.
Either he's really blind or he's fixing the match. I can't see it any other way.
I'm trying to get Sir Bob on my side here by saying City will win the Premier League.
It is an upset. You would expect Man United to go and win there.
Over $1 billion was paid in transfer fees between the clubs in Europe.
It's football. It's damn football. Like Ferguson said, football. Bloody marvellous.
Yeah, well, the celebration was, I can't believe I just scored against Mexico.
At one point, Parma, I think it's only like 224 players under contract.
But they're going to throw me out of here, fellas. You're going to get me arrested on your show.
If you're a serious talent, you're going back and you're playing for Santos. You know, you're going back to play for, like, in Argentina for River Plate or Boca Juniors, or you're going to Europe.
He looked like the Ryan Giggs of old. He was more creative than any player on the pitch. He made Mata look stupid. He made Rooney look silly.
Now, the Premier League is the most exciting league out there. I think it's probably the best marketed league without a question.
When you look at the draw for the Champions League, you kind of say, well, all the pieces kind of fell into place for everybody except City.
I am your host, Joe Uccello.
Sir Bob, Mike Orr. My co-host, Rob Rojas.
My trusted co-host, Ben the Machine.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to episode 313 of Low Limit Football on this 24th of January, 2021. I'm your host, Joe Uccello, and tonight, the EPL loses another big star to COVID as Sergio Aguero is ruled out by a positive test for Manchester City. Real Madrid are knocked out of the Copa del Rey by third division side Alcoyano, prompting the rumors of Zinedine Zidane's departure. Juve win the Italian Super Cup, the first trophy for boss Andrea Pirlo in his coaching career. And the European Super League has been rejected by FIFA with the threat to ban any players in the proposed competition from competing at the World Cup. The halfway points of our seasons show Atleti on top in La Liga, Man U in the EPL, PSG in France, Bayern Munich in Germany, and AC Milan in Italy. And we're going to discuss Italy and much, much more with our special guest, soccer internet personality Christine Cupo, who will be joining us in just a little bit. But first, let me get my co-host in here, Mr. Roberto Rojas. How was your week, my man?
It's been good, Joe. Thank you for having me. I think we've been very blessed with a lot of news in football. I think, obviously, as we also recover from a previous administration and kind of obviously open a new chapter here in the United States. I mean, we are definitely happy to see a lot of Americans perform well, actually. I think we've seen, you know, players such as Josh Sargent, Matthew Hope, Tyler Adams, and obviously Weston McKennie, who have been flourishing all in Europe this week.
Yeah, it's been a full week, no matter which news cycle you're looking at. I mean, between, you know, the swearing in here in the United States for President Biden. You look at, like we said, a lot of soccer news, whether we're talking about the Euros, whether we're talking about the World Cup, whether we're talking about, you know, even just the basic leagues themselves. You know, COVID has obviously still been front and center in the news. You know, even the UFC last night, there's been a lot of news this week. But we just, you know, it's our world. It's a 24-second news cycle, not a 24-hour news cycle. So as it comes at us, some of these things may seem like old news, but maybe you'd heard it for the first time. So who knows? Let's table that, though. Let's get into our first things first. You have the honor of trivia, my friend, today. So why don't you hit me with it, and I'll see what I can do.
Let's do it. So, looking into the championships that have been going on, we did see a champion this week, and Joe, in the Copa Sudamericana, where Defensa y Justicia were the champions of the Europa League equivalent of the of South America, defeating Lanús 3-0. Hernán Crespo getting his first title as coach as a head manager. So, very happy for him. And just a general question for you. This tournament has been going on since 2002. So only 20 years that the tournament's been going on, Joe, or about to be 20 years. And Defensa y Justicia is the newest team to win this title. How many different teams have won the Copa Sudamericana in its last 20 years?
Wow, that's an interesting question. Boy, you know what? I'm going to have to think about it. I'm trying to think if there have been any repeat champions that I can remember. So let's table that. That is a great question, and we will absolutely get you the answer to that question at the end of the show. So let's move on to our opening thoughts topic for tonight. And our opening thoughts topic surrounds the Euro 2020 and the anticipation of this tournament going off here in this summer. This is prompted by a couple of things. One, there were apparently false reports, but reports coming out that Tokyo was looking to cancel the 2020 Olympics due to COVID. It was since announced by the Olympic Committee that it had not been canceled, that they are still planning to move forward with the competitions. But it does ring a very serious bell about the fact that we are a year beyond canceling or postponing that competition, as well as the Euros, where this will come into play for us. And we still don't have certainty. We don't have security. We don't have safety. We've seen these tournaments, or these teams, these leagues pull off, smaller tournaments. We saw the MLS's back tournament where they played in a bubble. We saw them finish off the Champions League in a bubble as well in Portugal, if you remember, for 2020. And now we move on to the Euro here, where this is supposed to be set up as a 12-city plan or a 12-city tour, given the, I believe, the 60th anniversary of the competition. You doing it over 12 different cities right now is posing the biggest problem to having this competition go off this summer without a hitch. It's been brought up that maybe they should reduce it, reduce the size of it, and maybe even turn it into a single country, or some have even proposed a single city. There have been a couple of articles on this, but Roberto, you and I have talked about this particular competition during the week once this news came out. And I think you and I both agreed that if it were narrowed down to a country, we would have to look at a country that is doing progressively well with COVID and with containing the infection and the virus. And you and I think ultimately nailed it down to three countries in Europe. The article that I've read, which was Inside World Football by Andrew Warshaw, had suggested in my reading of it that Russia would be an option. And I don't think you and I discussed Russia as an option, strictly because I think the reporting of COVID cases out of Russia can be a little spotty. The information coming out is usually controlled, as it is always in that country when it comes to information in general. So you and I, I think you and I settled on one country, and I want to get your thoughts on it. But for me, the three countries that I brought up, one is, of course, a major player in world football, and that's the country of Germany. We saw them pull off the 2006 World Cup without a hitch, of course. We've seen them really do a great job in terms of controlling football matches with COVID. They were one of the first ones to come back from COVID, if you remember, and set up kind of this no fans, the testing regimen. They've really done a great job with it in terms of their players and their league teams. The other two countries are certainly outliers in terms of hosting a football competition. But in terms of when you relate the COVID numbers to how they're doing with COVID versus the competition itself, the two other countries that came to mind for me that I pointed out to you were Norway and Finland. Now, these are not traditional soccer powerhouses. These are not places that traditionally hold soccer tournaments. I mean, you think of Finland, you think of a hockey tournament. But we've never seen them host something big like this. I think there is potential, especially in Norway, for this to happen. But it is something that would have to take... You'd have to explore it in a microwave at this point, because you're going to need to make a plan. I don't think the 12-city plan is going to happen. I don't think the ability for these teams to go from Rome to Amsterdam to London to Lisbon to, to Munich is going to work, because you're just not going to be able to control the exposures of the players as they move from place to place. So I don't think we're going to see a 12-city Euro this year. I think if we're going to see a Euro, I think we're going to have to see it in one country. And in the article that I read, if you're going to do it in one city, as outlandish as this may sound, it might be the only city that can do it, and this is London. because of the plethora of stadiums that are available to you. But right now, England is one of those countries that is really having a hard time with coronavirus. They have their own strain at this point. So I don't know that doing it just in London is going to be a great option. I think it's a considerable option. But I think ultimately we're going to see this move to a place like Germany, don't you think?
Yeah, and as I look into my TV right now, Joe, as Bayern take the lead against Schalke, you also have to look at what they've been doing in terms of their leagues. I mean, you haven't seen games be postponed, or if they are postponed, they're very few, as in comparison to what we're seeing in Spain, as we're seeing in Italy, in Germany, sorry, in England as well. And you're right. I think as a country as a whole, they are the more reasonable pick. They have the space, given that they've hosted World Cups, they've hosted Euros, they have the history of hosting tournaments. In comparison to those Scandinavian countries that you had mentioned, I think while they are not traditional powerhouses of football, they are definitely capable of hosting such a tournament. But at the same time, just because of the number amount of people, of teams, and those facilities that are needed for a tournament like this, it has to be done in a more bigger country, but obviously it has a better control of the coronavirus. Mm-hmm. To do it in multiple cities where you're traveling, and mind you, Joe, we don't know what will happen when the tournament kicks off or is going to kick off in June. You know, maybe we're out of it. Maybe we're still in it. We don't know. We don't know what could happen. Obviously, with these strains, it could make things much worse than what we expect. So, yeah, I think if the tournament were to go on schedule, you would have to favor it in just one city or in one country, just like what they did at the UEFA Champions League when they had the bubble tournaments in Lisbon. So yeah, we definitely have to see what's up with that. But I think I agree. I think it ultimately has to be done in one single facility. I don't know if London is the great place to do it as well, as you said, Joe, with that new strain of the coronavirus in England, and you know they have the space, obviously, given the history and the plethora of clubs that play there. But at the same time, I think if you're more situated in a country that obviously has a control of the coronavirus, has the space, and has a good reputation, you would say, of getting these type of tournaments on without any issues, I think all the boxes are checked off for Germany. So. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it will definitely be interesting to see what happens there. But ultimately, if they were to do a single tournament, a single city tournament or a single nation tournament, I think it has to be done in Germany.
I agree with you. I like the point that you bring up, the Lisbon UEFA Champions League. The only problem with doing it in a single city is the fact that instead of dealing with eight teams here going into this tournament where we were with the Champions League, if I remember correctly, we're dealing with 24 teams. It's a much, much bigger ask. It's a bigger ask just for training spaces for the players and the teams. It's a bigger ask for hotel space for the players and the teams. So you need a city that would be capable of doing it. And you know, London does make sense. There's tons of places to play in London. And even Wembley, where no particular team plays, you know, it's just the national team. So it's London. If we had to do this in a city, London is, I think, the best equipped to do it. I think doing it in the city of London right now, given where we stand, and again, given the fact that we have to plan this. This is not something that is we can just make a phone call and go, okay, everyone fly to London tomorrow and we're going to kick this tournament off because that's where we're going to do it. It's going to take a lot of time, and it's something that if we're going to change or if UEFA is going to change this, they're going to have to change this you know, very, very quickly. They're going to have to change it, you know, with everything in mind. And I think Germany does bring up the point. You brought up a couple of good points in our chat about the NBA bubble having 22 teams, and that makes sense. But again, when you're, you know, the one thing with NBA courts is you don't really have to resurface them, right? You're not killing a live plant by running on grass with 22 players for 90 minutes. So that's why the fields themselves need time to heal. We've seen, you know, what bad pitches can look like in soccer. We've seen it even this week with a lot of the Copa del Rey matches. We've seen them look, you know, on some pretty ugly pitches. MLS is back. They did use a couple of different pitches, and the Wide World of Sports Complex did also have some training facilities. So there is the ability to run that kind of tournament in a place like that. And it was also spread out a little where you're only getting a couple matches a day, maybe two or three total. So I think we, I think you're right. I think we have to do this in Germany. I think if they narrowed it down to maybe six cities or something like that, that would be the best way to do it. In your opinion, when do you think UEFA needs to pull the trigger on this? Is this something where we're sitting here April 1st and they still have a 12-city plan, or do you think that they make that change before that?
I mean, obviously, this isn't to say that UEFA are slackers in this kind of sense, because we have seen how decisions are quickly made, as we saw in the Champions League in their bubble in Lisbon. And also, Joe, I just mentioned, he also had a sort of bubble in the Europa League last season, where I think starting in the quarterfinals, they had teams playing in neutral venues. I think the round of 16, if I'm not mistaken either. But they did that as well. So obviously they have the history of working in that type of environment. But in terms of when to do it, I mean, you would have to say it has to be done by the time the seasons are about to wrap up, or at least there, that some decision has to be made. I think the international break as well would be a perfect way to do it in March, that, like, you see, you know, assuming that teams are able to travel across the world playing competitions, like in South America, for example. You have to see, because also, Joe, they have to deal with their tournament as well. They have the Copa America. It's scheduled to be in Argentina and Colombia, but another decision as to, you know, obviously the coronavirus is not exactly doing its best to leave over there in that continent, so they definitely have other issues to worry about. But I think it will definitely have to be very soon. I think they have to ultimately, I'm sure they already have some sort of backup plan to see what will happen for them in the summer. So yeah, I would assume that they have to do it as soon as possible, or at least like have UEFA inform the 24 FAs and the national teams that are going to be involved in this tournament that, hey, you know, we don't know what's going to go on. We maybe are going to do this in a single city or a single country or something along those lines. I'm sure they're already giving that kind of backup plan, but I think they definitely have to act on it sooner than later.
Last opinion question on this before we close the topic, and I'll give you my opinion first, is I don't think they cancel it. Let's put it that way. I think this tournament will happen this time around. I think we are a year ahead of everything in our knowledge. I think we are a year experienced in planning tournaments like this, with bubbles, with isolations, with that sort of thing. I think this tournament does happen. In your opinion, do you think this tournament happens?
I do. I think as well the issue will be if the priority is given for the vaccines for these players. I mean, it's 23 players of 24 teams. That's like 550-ish players. You also have to give it to the coaching staff, to those that are involved in the competition as well. So it definitely will be interesting to see if the priority is given for those type of people that are involved in the tournament. So I would say that, yes, it does still happen. But again, we're all basing this off of speculation, really. But if you want me to go and pull the trigger as to like what could indeed happen, I think the tournament goes on. And for my money, I think it's worth it that they do it in a single venue.
Yeah, you bring up, you know, just spitballing the figures, you're talking something about 3,000 doses for about 1,500 participants, whether it be ushers, coaches, players, trainers. You know, that would take something in and of itself. It you know, given the numbers of vaccinations that we're talking about.
Well, let me ask you this as well. Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask you this. Would it be wise for them to not allow fans to come to the games?
Yeah, I think so. I don't think this tournament will have fans at all, vaccinated or not. If they did, it would involve two things. It would involve, one, that the fans would be vaccinated, and two, it would be a significantly diminished population. So a stadium that would hold, let's give a figure of 20,000, I think you maybe see 10%. I think you see 2,000, maybe 3,000 fans at the most, and possibly 2,000 to 3,000 fans that are vaccinated. Something similar to what the Super Bowl, the NFL, did this year, where they invited 7,500 vaccinated healthcare workers to the Super Bowl free of charge. I think one of the key words in the announcement was the fact that they're vaccinated. They've gotten both doses of their vaccines, whether it be Moderna or Pfizer. So I think that if you do see any fans at this competition, regardless of where it's held, and again, that's all going to be based on national,
you know, rules and regulations. So let's say this were done as a single city tournament in London. London right now will not allow the guy to clean the toilets into the building. So you will not see fans there. But I think in Germany, I think there is a potential, given that the fans are vaccinated. I think that the German government has been very, very cautious with these types of things. I think you could see fans, but it would be at a significantly diminished capacity, just strictly to be safe, not only the safety of the players, but the fans and then the people. And you also, you know, Roberto, you think about this. If, you know, I just mentioned 3,000 doses roughly for about 1,500 participants. When you expand it to allowing even 2,000 fans, you're going to need ushers. You're going to need police. You're going to need, even if you closed concessions and just strictly did, you know, police, you know, ushers and that sort of thing, you're almost doubling the amount of vaccines doses that you would need to cover that. So that number goes from 3,000 to 6,000. It's significant. And I think that that's going to have to be a consideration if they do go and have fans at any of these tournaments. So ultimately, I think this happens in Germany. Do you?
Yes. Yes, yeah. I do.
I think so, too. So, well, let's pray that the tournament does go off. And with that, we will close the segment. Just before we recorded today's show, we were joined by Christine Kupo to talk a little bit of Arsenal, but mainly Serie A and really a lot of Juventus and even some chocolate chip cookies. So without further ado, the Christine Kupo interview. Joining us now on Low Limit Football, soccer internet personality, Christine Kupo. Christine, welcome back to the show. It's great to have you back. First things first, how were the cookies yesterday?
Outstanding. I'd give myself the 10 out of 10. they're the first time that I did the Lavang copycats, and quite frankly, no complaints from me. I actually had one for breakfast while I was watching Juve Bologna. I'll probably have one for lunch. Like, it's just my straight cookie diet. This is this part of the pandemic we're hitting. So, but happy to be back and happy to give you my full regal of my cookies.
There's nothing wrong with cookies for breakfast, lunch, or dinner. Let's just make sure we get that fact out there first. So I guess let's jump into the football, because I want to ask you a general question about the Serie A. We're pretty much at the halfway point, give or take a match here. I know we have to make up the Juve-Napoli match from much earlier in the season. We see AC Milan sitting at the top, Inter Milan 2 points behind them, both of them dropping massive points on the weekend, especially with AC Milan with the big 3-0 loss to Atalanta. What are your overall impressions of the Serie A season so far at the halfway point?
I think that it's been close, despite the fact that, you know, Juve has been further down the table than we're used to. Right now we're 7 points behind. We could drop some points when a few games ahead when Napoli, because they're quick to jump ahead of us too. I think that Atalanta win over the weekend was significant and certainly helped to propel us, but like, we need to bolster ourselves on all wins now. Hopefully our days of draws and sort of spotty service are behind us. I think that, hopefully, fingers crossed in my mind, Supercopa will help with some of that. We definitely needed the morale boost, but I feel like we're largely erratic this whole season as far as Juve goes. And I think that we're still trying to get our footing. And I don't know that we're really going to get there before the end of the season. But I think that when we play our hearts out and we're on top of our game, it's beautiful. We've had some really ugly draws. We have an ugly loss or two, but I think we're getting there.
Well, I have to ask, Christine, going back to that cookie conversation, do you accept deliveries? Because I think Joe and I would definitely need some here in Connecticut.
For you guys, I'd figure out a way. I'll let you in on the next batch.
Awesome. But actually, going back to Juve, I mean, yes, you would say that this is Juventus. This is a side that, and I remember going back to our conversation we had at the beginning of the season, that, you know, with Andrea Pirlo coming in, we didn't know what to expect, but at the same time, we kind of did, because this is Juventus and they always aspire to get all the major titles that there are out there. And this isn't to say that Juventus are actually out of the Serie A race. I think they're far from it. I think they're still quite in it. But having said that, Christine, and I'm curious to hear what you think, do you feel as if, though, that they are, like, well in it, especially now with Milan and Inter dropping points? I mean, you know, you're still going to have the likes of a Roma, Atalanta, Lazio, Napoli, you know, those teams that are always going to be tricky for any team, not just Juventus. But given the fact that, you know, they're still in the Champions League, you know, they have to play Porto in the round of 16, and given the depth that they also have, and, you know, I think that just shows and proves what teams who go out and win the title, that's what they're really dependent on. Is it really harsh to count on this Juventus side towards the end of the season?
I think that I'm probably right now in the minority of folks who would say that we're down, but we're not out. I haven't given up on the Scudetto this year yet, but it's going to be a tight one for sure. I remain optimistic, but I think that a lot of folks would probably argue with me that it's a wrap. I will say that I think we should be probably devoting all of our energy now to Serie A. I don't think that we're in a place to be real contenders in Champions League. Not that that hasn't been the case in the past, but I think that this season isn't it, right? Like we have a really packed fixture schedule going on with COVID, especially games that we have to make up and then just a bunch of variables. I don't think this is the time for us to try to win Champions League. I just don't think we have a few things that we need to fix. Like we don't really have a 10, like we need to work our bugs out before we hit there. But I'd say next season, I'm far more ready to lock and load on Champions League, I'd say. I don't think that's there for us this season.
I'm actually curious about that, because I was about to say, I mean, obviously this isn't to say that Porto are an easy team, but you would assume that given what Juve have done in the Champions League, that they have all the right to aspire to win it, don't you think?
I think there are, everybody's going to murder me. I think there are better teams. I think there are better teams that have been firing on all pistons. Our issue is that we are very erratic. So we have very good games and then we have very, very poor games and there's no in between. And there's also no telling which Juve is showing up on that day. So I don't have the level of certainty around them right now. I think that this season, sort of the whole theme is resilience. And I think we've got that. And I think that we have a lot of really great players that are sort of coming into their own, but I don't think that we need to be sort of diversifying. And I know that Champions League is obviously something that we've been vying for. Sarri would probably not have been sacked if things had gone differently in Champions League. And that's sort of now our white whale.
Well, Christine, I'm actually curious because, you know, I think what we came in with Andrea Pirlo, obviously we spoke about this, how, you know, he came in, this is his first major job. You know, he had the U23s for like, what, a week or something, and then he gets the senior job. So, but I am curious about what you say about them being so inconsistent. Why do you feel that they are, given the talent that they have at their disposal?
I think it's a combination of we're missing a few key roles. And I think it's also just kind of trying to work the bugs out. Like Pirlo has a very specific system that he wants to be playing. He wants to be pressing. He wants to be playing wide. He wants us to move with pace. So there's a lot that we can do. But right now, coincidentally, the one player that's truly standing out is the one that's the most capable of playing the way that he wants them playing. And that's McKennie. So I think that it's a matter of a lot of figuring, right? Like, so poor Dybala, his role has been kind of minimized, but realistically, Dybala is more of a forward than a midfielder. So we don't have a 10. Now, do we have people that are capable of sort of filling that role? Sure. For example, I would argue that Ramsey and McKennie can essentially play the same role, but Ramsey's also played the 10 role for Wales. So if we had to, we could make some adjustments, but I think that's something that we needed to pick up. And I don't think it's happening in the January transfer window, but I think maybe in the summer we'll figure that out. But we're missing that key player that is sort of that spark that if we're down, which we have been, can sort of pivot and sort of be that change and keep us firing all pistons.
Well, it's good that you mentioned McKennie, because that's actually a good segue to my next question, because, you know, what we spoke about at the beginning of the season in our chat the last time we had you was the case about what McKennie was going to bring and what kind of impact that he was going to have on this Juventus side, especially given that he was coming off on loan from Schalke. And to all our expectations, he has exceeded all of them. I think he's been absolutely terrific. I know you have a big appreciation towards him, seeing it on your Twitter feed, but he's just incredible. I think he's a player that's so versatile. You see him everywhere. He likes to track back. He's not afraid to go in and go on the attack. You know, he just works so hard. And to even say that when Juve are in possession, he's basically leading the line. I think he's just been so versatile. So, and the question is not going to be that, do you feel that Juventus are going to keep him? Because I think 100% they would be foolish not to. But at this point, and given the fact that he's young and, you know, this is a side that also needs to do some fixing, as you said, with getting key pieces, do you feel that with McKennie, in terms of his capability and his potential, that this is the player that Juventus should central their style towards, or like he's basically controlling everything that Juventus are trying to go through moving forward?
I think that I don't think that they're necessarily tailoring things to his style, or that they will, but I think that he very much plays to Pirlo's desired style, and that's what we're gravitating toward, or that's the goal, right? So the hope and what seems to be in the pipe for Pirlo, at least, is he's looking at a lot of young players who can fill a need in the future, not necessarily right now. So we saw some of that buzz with Brian Reynolds come up. And again, kid's great, amazing defender, would fit in the system perfectly, but shy on minutes. So definitely not a right now player, definitely an on loan player, somebody that we can circle back to, but definitely a bargain deal. So I think that that's kind of where Pirlo's head is at. Like, where do I plug this for the future? And to me, that just speaks to some of the faith that overall management has in Pirlo, and that we'll probably see him around for a while, which is also a little bit surprising to me, because coming into this, Pirlo very much to me struck me as sort of this emergency bandage for sort of our impetuous firing of Sarri, which was clearly highly emotional and extremely uncharacteristic of Juve. And now I'm kind of seeing this turn where it seems that they're affording him with the time and energy and commitment to make this team into what he believes would be the team to beat. So it's interesting.
It really is. And obviously, I think many people, as you said, would probably agree that maybe this Juventus side for next season could be exactly much more better than they are. So it'll be curious to see what happens to them and what kind of key pieces that they do need in order to move forward. And as you said, fire on all cylinders, especially in the Champions League. I just want to switch gears real quick and talk about the other team that kind of has stressed you out and gave you bad mornings most of the season, and that's Arsenal. I remember you were saying how optimistic you were, and I'm afraid that that's going to be a freezing cold take on this part, because we have seen an Arsenal side that has been very inconsistent under Arteta. I mean, obviously, they are still in the Europa League, but they have been knocked out of the FA Cup. You know, I think they definitely need to just try to become much more of a consistent side. They are rumored to get a certain Martin Odegaard, who is striving to get minutes, given the fact that he's not getting that much at Real Madrid. How do you feel about that move? And would that be a good one for Arsenal? And also, just what are your, I guess, expectations moving forward for the second half of the season?
Arsenal is such a tricky, tricky beast for me right now, because you're right. I was so, so optimistic, and I was sort of banking on the pivot that, like, okay, the dressing room sounds like they've got it together and there's no problems. And subsequent to that time we spoke, you know, we had sort of this Ozil issue, and then we had leaks coming from the dressing room. Like, it seems like everything that we thought was falling into place was actually just momentarily paused, and it got worse. Things on field have not been pretty, to say the least. And I know that typically we look at things like the FA Cup and shrug and say, okay, fine, but it's the FA Cup. But what I'll say, I will posit the idea that the FA Cup to Arsenal is like the Supercopa to Juve. Largely insignificant, but means a whole lot more if you lose it. Mm-hmm. So I feel like that's sort of a harbinger for this season for them. I don't know what changes are going to actually fix this team. I want to believe that that it's fixable, but I think that we're probably going to just sort of limp through the rest of the season and hopefully come back stronger next year. It's just there hasn't been enough consistency to even say that it's been a manic performance. It's touch and go to the point that they're so unreliable that I personally, I don't know. If I were managing that team at this point, I would just be in tears. And I mean, that's not to say that I'm not in tears, but it's, I feel like it's a particularly low point for Arsenal. And for me, it's just sad because you just, how do we end up like waving from like essentially what is nearly the bottom of the table? It's a very huge, like, my how mighty have fallen story, and I don't enjoy the ride anymore. I want off.
You know, you made an interesting point about the Supercopa with Juventus, because I think you're 100% correct, where if Juve win the Supercopa, we're like, yeah, okay, great, we won it. It's a nice trophy, whatever. But if they lose it, it's way more damaging. You know, I looked at the Supercopa as Pirlo saving his job. There had been plenty of rumors leading up to the Supercopa because of the inconsistencies that maybe Pirlo wasn't the right guy. There had been rumors about him possibly, you know, being sacked even, which I don't think is going to happen. I think that the Agnelli family is in for the long haul with Andrea Pirlo.
But I don't think that's going to happen, as much as people want to sort of try to create these sort of incendiary headlines. I think he's ingratiated himself with the Agnellis, and they have, whether people agree with it or not, have committed to him. But we need that, right? We need them to commit to somebody. We can't have every season be, two seasons in and firing. That's not how you build or continue a legacy of winning. Right. We had been on the decline where we've had some really decent seasons on paper, but the reality of that is we haven't played beautiful football in a long time.
Yep. Now, let me ask you this. Given the significance / insignificance of the Supercopa from the Juventus point of view, what does that victory do for Andrea Pirlo moving forward? I mean, this is his first piece of hardware he's added to the case as a manager. This is somebody who has won it all as a player. So as a manager, what does that do for his confidence moving forward and in terms of how he manages matches moving down the road?
I think that he, despite the fact that his disposition is very much of like unimpressed sourpuss, even when he is absolutely elated, and I love that about him, I think that he needed it. I think that whether or not anyone wants to admit it, it gives him that first bit of validation as a manager to demonstrate, like, listen, whereas conversely, if he had lost it, this would have literally been a stain on his entire record. And there would be little room in the media to mitigate some of the louder shouts that are extremely negative. Now, would anything have come of that or from that? I don't think so. But I think that morale-wise, in terms of keeping the reins on this team and continuing to build, it needed to happen. Mm-hmm. I don't think that we would be, I don't think we would have beat Bologna, honestly, had we not won that. Because we already took one on the chin with Inter, and that's not the first time that we've had matches like that this season that, you know, we're either close or that we could have won or should have won or things didn't go our way. But I think that having that bit of silverware attached to it, like we needed it. Mm-hmm. And we got it, thank God.
No, I agree. I want to look at a couple more positions here. First, I want to look at the Chiesa Bernardeschi situation, because Chiesa featured in the Derby d'Italia, and obviously we know what happened there, although he wasn't the worst player in the match for Juve. But since then, in the Copa, in the Supercopa and against Bologna, we've seen Bernardeschi feature instead. Do we see a pendulum swinging back to Bernardeschi? Do you think that maybe playing Bernardeschi over Chiesa over these past few matches is maybe a way to kind of showcase him for a transfer? Because otherwise, he hasn't been getting any time. And I know we've talked about Weston McKennie as one of the really big bright spots for Juve this season so far. But Federico Chiesa has been one of those big bright spots as well for me. So, you know, what do you think's going on there between those two players?
So I think that you are right. I think that tossing Berna in has largely been more of a showcase than anything else. I think that despite the fact that there are few who are extremely attached to that man, I hold no malice, but I think that it's time. He's effective when he's effective and he otherwise isn't. I think for me, I had issues early on because there was so much hype around Chiesa. And I was part of it, right? I was very excited. I was entirely convinced that he was coming from a big, big fish, small pond scenario, and he needed to be in a team like Juve to thrive. And I think that maybe my expectations were extremely high. And so from my perception, he got a really slow start and I wasn't impressed. And I was sort of like, okay, what did we do the right thing? Like, is this kid worth it? And I think that, yes, it took some time, but we're finally seeing it now. We're seeing what I expected to see, maybe selfishly, earlier on when he got to Juve. But that's not terribly different from Arthur, who I also was not super duper duper in love with when we picked him up. Got here from Barca over the summer and has been very meh for me. But also very Brazilian. He loves to just sort of dribble around in circles. But I was like, you know, what are we doing? Is this going to work? And then, you know, he kind of came in and proved himself today. And I'm elated that he finally got his first goal. But it seems like things are starting to gel as we expected early on. And maybe it's just that I had unreasonable expectations for this team. But I think that we'll see probably... in terms of exits, like Bernardeschi will probably be one of the next to go. As things start to form sort of the way that Pirlo sees them going forward, there's going to be a lot of redundancy and or just inadequacy that we need to move beyond.
Yeah, you, I think you're living inside my brain right now because my next question was actually going to be about Arthur. Because I agree with you. He had a very slow start coming over with the Pjanic trade and everything. And I was kind of like, you know, what are we getting out of this guy? This guy was supposed to be the younger version of Pjanic. And right now he's the younger version of not nearly as good as Pjanic. And like you said, very Brazilian, likes to dribble around in circles. But, you know, there is almost a tempo setting to his dribbling prowess and his ability to kind of regroup the ball, settle things down, kind of set a tone, set a pace. We've seen it come out much, much more in the past few matches that he's played, including today against Bologna and including the Super Cup. So for me, when I look at the midfield right now where we stand today, I think McKennie's one of the first names you have to write down on the starting 11. I also think Arthur is one of the ones that you have to write down on the starting 11 immediately. My questions really are around Rodrigo Betancourt at this time. He's had his opportunity now for quite some time. You have Adrian Rabiot, again, who's another hot and cold kind of guy. When he's hot, he's super hot. And when he's cold, he's like, eh. But Betancourt doesn't give you or has not shown the ability to be as hot or as hot for as long as a guy like Rabiot. So for me, when does Pirlo give up on Betancourt, and maybe even when does Juve give up on Rodrigo Betancourt?
It's funny because you're kind of hitting on those that I think are probably up for most question, especially this season. And I agree with you. I think that I don't know if we're seeing everything that Betancourt has to offer at this point, and it's just not enough. But I if I had to unload some folks, it would probably be Bernardeschi and Betancourt. When he's good, he's good. When he's not, you're just sort of so frustrated with him that you're beyond words. And I don't know what exactly is going on with him, because you see he plays really well, and it's just so infrequent. So I don't know how to solve that problem, or if maybe Pirlo has like the expert cheat code to that Rubik's Cube, but I haven't seen it since he's been helming this team. So I don't know that it's him.
Well, I hope he finds it soon, because like I said, when Betancourt's good, he's good.
But yeah, I totally agree. That's what makes it hard, because you're sort of like, no, I've seen this man perform and it's great. And so you don't want to count him out, but you also don't know what causes these sort of huge pendulum swings in how he's playing.
Right. Exactly. It's mind-boggling, but hopefully they figure it out soon. Before we let you go, where can everybody find your work?
You can always find me shouting at the internet on Twitter at C Cupo. I'm also on Instagram at Miss Cupo, MISSCUPO. Always happy to field questions or just shout at clouds with you over various soccer things. I enjoy it thoroughly.
Yeah, I was gonna say, you're not old enough to the get off my lawn part yet, but
not yet. But you know, I'm definitely hitting the clouds for sure. I've done it a few times this season, and I'm like, oh wow, am I proud of myself? ?
No, great stuff. Again, thank you for coming on the show again and joining us to chat, especially Juve, which I personally always enjoy. All the best, stay safe, and we'll definitely get together and talk again soon after Juve win the Scudetto and maybe the Champions League.
Yes, and I absolutely owe you guys cookies. So thanks for having me again. Always love chatting. Have a good remainder of your day.
And thanks again to Christine Cupo for joining us on the show. Roberto, we've got one more thing we want to talk about. It is kind of lead into our match of the week segment, but it is certainly the biggest match of the matches of the week this week, and it is the Copa Libertadores final, an all-Brazilian affair facing Santos against Palmeiras in the final. Santos, again, eliminating Boca Juniors on their way to this particular final, and Palmeiras eliminating River Plate, avoiding an all-Argentinian Supercopa final to get to this point as well. Palmeiras really had a fairly, I don't want to say an easy path, but certainly a very strong path, where they had only had a 0-0 draw with Guarani in this record up to the semifinals. And even in the semifinals, looked like they were going to steamroll with a 3-0 victory over River Plate in Buenos Aires. But then the return leg, the 2-0 loss at home, kind of raised a few eyebrows. And they really got by with the skin of their teeth, because that match was pressing. If I remember correctly, there were a couple goals that were disallowed by VAR for River Plate. So that could have very well gone the different way. Santos also had a similar run as well. They suffered a Guarani. I'm sorry, I'm reading the wrong list here. But they suffered another 0-0 draw to Olimpia, another Paraguayan side, and then otherwise had a fairly uneventful run, although they did have the 0-0 draw in the first leg to Boca Juniors, but then turned it on in the second leg with the 3-0 victory to end up in the final as well. If I remember correctly, and this is going off the top of my head, Palmeiras 3-time winner, Santos 1-time winner. Correct me on that one if I'm wrong. But how do you see this one playing out against two Brazilian giants?
Yeah, no, Joe, this is going to be a really good game. I think, obviously, these are two experienced sides. As you said, they have the history. They have won this competition before. So it will definitely be very, very interesting to see what happens. I think, obviously, these are two teams that have dominated the group stage. They had an interesting run in the final stages, in the round of 16, quarterfinals, semifinals. I think you can argue that Santos had the difficult path, because obviously they play Liga de Quito in altitude. They played a Grêmio side who are obviously no pushover, and they played Boca, and they've dominated Boca in that game. Whereas for Palmeiras, even though they had dominated teams like Tigre, Guarani, Bolívar, Delfín, Libertad, and then only losing to River Plate, but losing it at home, that was an eye-opener. But having said that, I think these are two dominant sides that like to play on possession. I think we'd like to see how Palmeiras are very effective on the break. I think they are very strong in that sense. I think Santos are going to try their best to absorb that pressure and also try to go on that break and obviously attack when you have very speedy wingers like Soteldo, like Caio Jorge, you got Marinho in there, but you have Palmeiras with players like Luis Adriano and whatnot, Gabriel Menino. I think these are two very talented sides. I don't want to say that it is a coin toss because it does feel that way, but I personally think, I think Abel Ferreira is doing a very good job with this side. I think Palmeiras have been absolutely convincing in one way or the other. I don't think what happened against River Plate will happen in this final. I think they understand their capability of trying to get a result and knowing that what had happened in that game was just a mere coincidence. So for that, I think that Palmeiras will go out and win this game. I think they are the side that are much more deeper. I think they are more talented in every right. I think even though Santos have had history, as you said, Joe, winning it three times, they have a manager that did win it, Cuca, who won it with Atlético Mineiro back in 2013. I just think that this Palmeiras side is much more talented. I think they are definitely a side that will want to absorb pressure and try to play on your half of the field first before going on the attack, and I think that's what Palmeiras will do. I think that's ultimately what will decide this final, how they play out to their advantages. If they are able to pressure out Santos, who are definitely going to go on the forefront in the beginning of the matchup, if they're able to control that and then go on the forefront to try to score, I think Palmeiras will get the result there. So I think, for me, I think Palmeiras will get that second star on the shirt and become the champions of the 2020/2021, because the game is obviously being played in 2021, but it's named the 2020 Copa Libertadores final. I see Palmeiras lifting the trophy at the Maracanã on the 30th.
Now, I want to ask you a quick question, because you did bring up the names of Marinho, Caio Jorge, and Soltero, the three being the attacking three of Santos, and there's a lot of youth there. Okay, Caio Jorge is 18 years old. Jefferson Soltero is 23, so there's still a lot of youth there. Is the lack of experience in this type of stage going to be the issue? Because, I mean, you're still pretty experienced in the Palmeiras back line, and Weverton, of course, as their goalkeeper, Brazilian national team, you know, we've talked about him plenty of times in the past. Do you think it's going to be the inexperience that kind of limits what Santos can do offensively, or do you think it's more of the experience of Palmeiras' defensive side that will manage this game and manage the speed that team offers?
Well, I think Palmeiras obviously have a lot of players that have won titles. You know, this is a side that won the Brazilian league 3 years ago. You have a lot of those players who have been champions of their domestic league. Champions in the Paulista, which is the São Paulo State tournament. They have proven winners on this side. So I think that experience can go a long way when it comes to a match like this. And I think ultimately that's probably what's going to decide this final. I think, you know, this isn't a Santos side that is inexperienced in the way that, you know, these guys are scrubs, basically. But they are talented. They are talented players, and they will surprise you. I mean, they've done it to two former champions in Grêmio and Boca. And then obviously the other key, I forgot, they also won a championship. So they've beaten three former champions on the way there. This isn't a small feat. So, but having said that, I think just because Palmeiras are a more effective side, they are more experienced, I think they're maybe even more talented on that perspective, I think that's what's going to decide who wins. I think it'll be a very close game. I ultimately, Joe, I would not be surprised if this game goes to extra time or penalties. I think that's how close it is. I don't really think it will be a convincing win for any of these two teams. I don't see like a 2-0, a 3-0. I think it'll be very, very close. And it might even go on penalties, honestly, if I have to give you my honest opinion. But I think Palmeiras goes and wins the title over at the Maracanã.
I think I'm going to drop a 2-1 Palmeiras on this one. I don't know that I think it will be a close match, just like you said. And like all championship finals, they'll start out a little tentatively. I don't think we'll see the high-flying stuff you normally see out of South American football to begin with, but I think it will evolve into that eventually, because it naturally always does for the most part. But I do think you'll see a 2-1 Palmeiras win on this one, and it should be a great one to see. So, again, our featured match of our matches of the week is going to be the Copa Libertadores final. Let me give you the rundown
for this week's matches of the week as we head into the week. Starting on Thursday, the big one in the EPL, Spurs-Liverpool, 3 p.m. will kick us off. And then we move to Saturday with Leipzig-Leverkusen in the Bundesliga at 12:30, Marseille-Rennes at 3 p.m. in Ligue 1, Villarreal Sociedad at 3 p.m. also on Saturday in La Liga, and of course the big one, our featured match of the week, Palmeiras-Santos in the Copa Libertadores final, also at 3 o'clock. Rob, somebody's got to make a phone call and say, hey, move the, you know, stagger these times because this is ridiculous. But that,
You know, someone's got to make money.
I guess. And on Sunday, we're going to close out with the Serie A with a big one as well. Atalanta Lazio open us up at 9 a.m. on Sunday morning, so that'll be definitely a big one to watch. My friend, before we started the our program, you gave us the trivia question, if you wouldn't mind repeating it.
Yes, absolutely. So, as we saw yesterday at the time of recording, Defensa y Justicia won the Copa Sudamericana, giving Hernan Crespo his first title as a manager, defeating Lanús 3-0, and are the latest champions of the Copa Sudamericana. Given that they are the latest champion to win the trophy, how many different teams have won the Copa Sudamericana in the 19 years that the tournament has existed?
Now, I'm obviously going to just take a guess at this, so I'm going to take two guesses, and I'll let you give me the higher or lower answer if I don't hit it on the nose, but I don't recall many repeat champions in this competition. So with 20 years of playing this competition, I'm going to say 13 different champions.
You are lower.
I am lower, so the number is higher than 13.
Correct.
That's what I thought. Let's go with 16 then.
Is that your final answer?
That is my final answer.
Defensa y Justicia were the 17th different champion of the Copa Sudamericana.
I said, you know, do you have the list in front of you? Do you know which teams?
I do.
Okay, which teams have won it more than once? Because I was going to say, I don't remember a lot of them.
There's a tie between two teams who have only won it twice, Boca Juniors and Independiente. But there have been 15 teams that have only won it once. I'll give you the order just in case, so that you could remember it in one of those like future trivia questions. the teams that have won the Copa Sudamericana, obviously Boca with two and Independiente with two, but the following have also won it. With Defensa y Justicia going in, they join Liga de Quito, Lanús, River Plate, San Lorenzo, Cienciano of Peru, Pachuca, Arsenal of Argentina, Internacional of Brazil, Universidad de Chile, São Paulo, Independiente Santa Fe of Colombia, Chapecoense, Atlético Paranaense, and Independiente del Valle.
That's right. That was that Chapecoense team that ended up in the plane crash as they were on their way to play the final, if I remember correctly.
That's right.
Yeah, that's some history certainly behind that cup in its short life, to say the least. So, great trivia question again, my friend. So without anything left on the docket, let's hit the closing music.
Let's do it.
All right, here we go. And so for episode 313 of Low Limit Football, special thanks again to Christine Kupo for joining us. Next week, we will recap the Copa Libertadores final, give you the champion and how the match went, as well as look forward into the second half of every season in Europe for the major leagues. So for episode 313 of Low Limit Football, I am Joe Uccello.
I'm Roberto Rojas.
Thanks for listening, everyone, and good night.